We're here this morning. Today is Saturday, October 25th, 2014. This is the last day of the last Mercury retrograde of the year. And we're here with Sarah McLean talking about meditation, love, and the power of attention. I'm so thrilled and honored to be on the call. And I just know that we'll receive some really, really interesting information today. And then also at the end of the call, Sarah will be gracious enough to just lead us through, you know, maybe 7 to 10 minutes with a guided meditation for the group. I really wanted to talk today because I feel that meditation is really such a powerful force, not just for things like keeping under wraps any kind of anxieties or keeping stress levels under control, but also it's a deeper and much broader force for transformation. I had first experienced meditation in high school, and it was an interesting thing. I discovered in the basement of an antique shop, I had found a stack of magazines, and one of them happened to be a 1968 edition of the Saturday Evening Post, and on that cover was a photograph of the Beatles with the Maharishi Mahesh Yogi, and I found this to be fascinating, and I always had loved the Beatles music. I had grown up with them, and my parents were big Beatles fans, and so, you know, I think I must have paid 25 cents or 50 cents for that Saturday Evening Post magazine, which I still have, and that was kind of the beginning of my meditation practice, which to me is funny now because, you know, as a high school student, I really had no idea what I was doing. And, you know, I would sit in my bedroom and just kind of sit there in what was a sort of lotus position and kind of get quiet, but not really know what to do. And I didn't have a meditation teacher. But it was years later that I had some martial arts training and then just recently gone through the meditation certificate. But in 2008, 2009, I actually had experienced some health issues in a period of real challenge for me. And that was when I really felt the shift in the power of meditation as a transformative experience, not just something that helps to mitigate stress or to keep it under wraps. So, you know, with Sarah McLean, I know she's the author of Soul Center, Transform Your Life in 8 Weeks with Meditation, which was published by Hay House in May of 2012. And of course, you know, Sarah's traveled, she's been all over the world and studied with amazing teachers, Deepak Chopra, Thich Nhat Hanh, and many others. I would really like to hear what Sarah has to say about that pivotal moment or event in her life in which she realized the magnitude and the power of meditation, not just, like I said, as a stress relief or as a way to kind of get quiet, but really as a transformative act. So, Sarah, could you share with us that piece?
Sure. Thanks for having me on the call, Kelly. And for those of you who just joined us, welcome. Kelly is she contacted me on the internet and just said, "Can you come and do this conversation with me?" And of course, I love to talk about meditation anytime with anyone, and I love to do it even more. But in terms of your background, starting with, you know, kind of being informed by the Beatles, that's exactly what I was like. I'm not sure, you're probably about my age, I would imagine. And I was sitting in the back of my, I used to skip school a lot, and I used to sit in the back of the subway going into Boston or in Harvard Square, where I would sit in the lotus position, sort of assuming the position and waiting to find the magic in meditation, which never did happen because when I closed my eyes, well, it didn't happen then, when I closed my eyes, I didn't really know how to meet my own mind. But as time went on, I definitely tried to learn to meditate or did take some introduction to meditation programs, once at a Zen Buddhist center. Once I did, when I was in college, I sat under this woman's pyramid in Northampton, Massachusetts, while she instructed me on how to do chakra meditations. Even though I didn't have an inkling of what meditation could do for me, there was this internal knowing that I needed to do it. I don't even know what it was. I think part of it was that I was extremely stressed out as a kid, almost chronic stress. So I eventually ended up in the military and became a soldier who was trained to treat other soldiers with chronic stress, even though I didn't realize I had it at the time. Sometimes we're the last to know. But ultimately, I remember one moment. I hear someone talking. I'm not sure.
Yeah, if you could just press star 6 or to mute your handset, that would be great so we don't have any interference in the background. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Only because I didn't know if you had a question. I keep thinking maybe I should ask if you have a question.
no, go ahead.
So I remember being in the military and having a nurse, as a male nurse, guide us through a body relaxation practice. And now that really showed me the benefit of, well, actually kind of set a new normal for me. I got a sense of what relaxation feels like. And I think that was the beginning of my really true continual search for the right kind of meditation. I ended up ultimately doing a couple of Zazen techniques, which are, you know, it's the Zen Buddhist tradition. It's the Japanese Buddhist tradition. And where I'd sit on a pillow and count my breaths. I did a lot of chanting. And then I practiced transcendental meditation. And I think right at that moment, I knew that I needed to make my lifestyle such that I could be supported in my meditation practice. I really found community to be essential. I didn't necessarily feel like I had a community in my own home. And I was always seeking community. And I know this may sound strange to those who are listening, but when I was in the military, you know, even though we had a different mission than when I was in the monastery, there was a camaraderie of people who were living, working, and literally sleeping in the same area together so that we really got to know each other on a very intimate level. And I feel like that was what was missing for me. So the transformation was not only the technique, but it was also really immersing myself in the community and really seeking out additional knowledge. And when you look at any practice, any spiritual practice, whether it's, like you say, martial arts or whether it's prayer or any kind of practice, even in working as a scientist in the physics, you need three pillars of, or I'd like to say three legs of a stool. The first one is your practice, whatever it may be. The second one is the knowledge that supports your practice. And the third leg on the stool is the community. And I think that's when I realized that there was such a transformative power, not just sitting by myself with my eyes closed, but being able to live in a community that supported my practice.
And that's, you know, what you say, it's so poignant because I felt moved just this last September to have an event at the Arcadia Park in Phoenix, which was part of this unify.org, which I know that you've seen, and I know we had sent a couple things back and forth online on Facebook about that. And that's really what it was about. It's about community and being able to connect with others who are, you know, either of like mind or same values or of same practice, and being able to use that as a transformational tool in that way. And I think it kind of gains a sort of momentum, and it also really maybe even exponentially kind of magnifies it. And that's really how I understand, too, what science is now calling this Maharishi effect, is that we're actually setting the intention and projecting this energy, and when that energy shifts and we utilize it as a group, we're actually seeing results, which is amazing. But I think you're right. It starts kind of at that root level of having that solid foundation of the individual, the personal, and then the community, and then it extends out from there. It's really quite amazing. I'm wondering then too, what you say about the practice. I think that there's often a misconception really about what goes on mentally during the meditation act, and especially for beginners who might have a conception that meditation is all about emptying your mind or not thinking any thoughts at all. I'm wondering if you could kind of debunk that and or describe what the intention is on a mental level for meditating, and then how does that also then relate to focus or being focused or having focus?
Okay. Well, that could be the whole rest of the phone call, but I'm totally happy to talk about it. So in general, yes, the big mystery or the big misconception or both is that when you close your eyes, that somehow people believe that they're supposed to stop thinking magically, that they already should know how to meditate and that their mind should be fully cooperative. And I know for sure, at least in my world and most of the people I teach, say that that's their first barrier to meditation, is that they don't think they're doing it correctly because they can't stop thinking. Now, that's a mythology that you're supposed to stop thinking by thinking about not thinking. It's impossible
right.
to do it. It's virtually impossible. It's the nature of your mind to think, just like it is the nature of your eye to see. It's just its nature. And there's a nature of it to be stimulated and to have about anywhere from 50 to 70,000 thoughts a day. It really depends on who you talk to, but it's about one thought every 2 seconds. And the mind is continually processing the information out there. And, you know, and just with any stimulus, if I say to you, let's just say, you know, you're sitting in a restaurant and you hear somebody say the word Hawaii, your mind is going to take a trip. It just does it. And that's like a figurative trip, but that's exactly what happens. Anything you look at can be the impetus for a long internal dialogue. And with meditation, when you sit down to meditate, because you usually close your eyes, the internal dialogue seems to get louder. So in meditation, I say there are three ingredients. First, your willingness to do it and actually do it. And secondly, your gentle attention. And the third ingredient is your focus for your meditation. To simply sit and say, okay, I'm not going to think, is not going to work. Because what is required is something to attach your attention to, whether it's something you see, something you feel, or something you hear. So it could be a mantra, a candle flame, a visualization, a night sky, a chant you're listening to, of your sensation of your breath. But we need to give the mind something to hold on to, an anchor. And so as we do that in the meditation practice, we train our attention in three ways. The first way is we become much more present. Because whatever you're going to look at, whether it's a star or pay attention to your breath, that's always something attached and happening in the present moment.
Yes.
That's the first thing. The second way you train your attention in meditation is you turn your attention inward. Even if you're gazing at a candle flame or a night sky, your attention is settled down and you start becoming more self-aware, including yourself in the relationship to the perception itself and the what is being perceived. And then the third way with meditation is you're training your attention to focus on one thing at a time, which is unitasking or monotasking. So in meditation, it is a training itself. It is the training for the ability or cultivating the ability to focus on one thing at a time, to be in the present moment, and to have more self-awareness.
And that actually leads me to an exercise that you have in your book, which is called Don't Believe Everything You Think. and I'm wondering what is really meant by don't believe everything you think. And I think, at least for me, where my mind goes when I see that statement or when I hear that statement is that there's somewhat of a relationship between thought and emotion. And so what does it mean to not believe everything you think? And then how does meditation impact the relationship between emotions and thought?
Okay, those are great questions. So if you look around where you're sitting right now, you may be under the impression that you are sitting perfectly still. But we know that the Earth is moving at about 1,000 miles an hour, and it's moving in relationship to the sun, which is moving. We know the galaxy is moving. And we know we're moving very, very quickly, but our senses would tell us we're sitting perfectly still. Mm-hmm. So we often think something that we perceive. You know, I'm sitting still, the tree is green, the birds are singing, you know, and those things we can believe, but the mind always wants to be right. And when it wants to be right and attaches to what it believes or perceives, it tends to veil or limit the ability to see what is actually there rather than what you think you see.
Mm-hmm.
So I'll give you another example. So look around wherever you're sitting and look for the color red. Find three items that are red.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, now close your eyes for a moment and picture those three items that are red in your mind's eye.
Okay.
Now, with your eyes still closed, picture the three blue items in your environment without opening your eyes.
Mm-hmm.
And now picture three yellow items in your environment.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. What you normally will identify is that you are always going to find what you're looking for. The
right.
mind wants to be right. If you open your eyes, you'll see the red, but then you'll see the blue. Now, as
right.
if you're looking for blue, it's more poignant. It's more prominent. And if you're looking for yellow, there it is. It sticks out in your attention because the mind always will look for what it's looking for. It will see what it's looking for. So when we're looking, when we think of a question, and I'm talking about beliefs that we have, like I'm not good enough, or they're much better at it than I am, or I'll never get anywhere, or the world is a horrible place, whatever those limiting beliefs are that you may have, you are going mm-hmm. to prove them to yourself because you will always find what you're looking for. So
yeah.
instead of assuming that those thoughts that cause suffering are correct, it might be mm-hmm. interesting to kind of look at or explore the relationship to your behavior and your thoughts. And you mentioned the thought and the feeling. With meditation, there's
yeah.
a number of things that happen. There's a spaciousness that happens between a thought and a feeling. Instead of reaction, we become reactive. We actually become more responsive. But in
right.
terms of the general creation, we have a thought. We see what we want to see. We have a feeling. We prove it to ourselves over and over and over again. It becomes kind of our religion. I
yeah.
mean, think of any thought that is self-limiting. And quite
yeah.
often in my retreats, you know, people will do that. They'll start identifying, you know, everything would be fine if only. If only
right.
they would, or she would, or he would, or this or that. You know, so it's really important to not believe it, because sometimes it's going to be limiting you to what's really going on, and it's not
yeah.
actually true.
Yeah. Yeah. And then do you think that as we have these thoughts that are not true, then maybe an emotional response is created, and that's kind of what keeps that piece on the hamster wheel, right? The limitation stays there, and then you're attached to it, and then it creates more limitation, then you become... Do you see that in the folks who study with you or in your own practice, and you know, that changing the focus kind of releases that? Is that...
Yeah,
that
you get a little break from the feedback loop with meditation.
Yeah.
You know, it opens the possibilities, it expands your awareness. I mean, back to my experience of working with people who are stressed out, quite often, and I'll just describe it, you know, their attention starts to become very narrow, starting to scan
yeah.
the environment for an enemy, whether it's somebody who's going to offend them emotionally or mentally or physically. You know, there's this limiting ability to only look for what is going to hurt them. And you know people like this. They tend to be victims. And it's really
right.
not their fault. It's just that the stress has accumulated so much that they don't see their environment or their life as a friendly place to be. And so what happens when we start to include meditation as a regular component is that we start to create a new normal, a normal of feeling this ability to relax, this ability to receive and not be reactive to our environment. So if someone cuts you off in traffic, there are two ways to respond. You know, one way is to get on their tail and make them pay for it, or to realize that maybe you needed to go slower and that you're totally, you know, it's not personal, you know, and
right.
we each have our own ways that we respond to people, inanimate objects, to ourselves mm-hmm. when we're stressed out. And I think with meditation, it allows us to be a little more thoughtful, a little more aware of the consequences of blindly believing something just because we think it.
Yeah.
You know, and
yeah.
we want to be right. We want to be proving ourselves and right, but...
Right.
Yeah, but anyway, that's my feeling. It creates this amazing ability to see from another perspective.
Yeah, yeah. And I find, too, that there's sort of, in my own practice, there's sort of like this paradoxical kind of thing that happens that, you know, we get caught up in our daily routines, our daily habits, or whatever it is that we're doing, and then we create this practice in which we devote time or create a place or sanctuary spot in our home where we consciously make a choice to slow down and have this practice. But then I think what happens when we're actually in the practice and we're, as you say, like in that present moment, and we are cultivating a deeper sense of self-awareness so that we can do things like, you know, breaking these feedback loops or sort of working through these limiting beliefs, I feel like what actually happens, though, is that we end up having, it almost like it shifts time. We end up having more time. And then I find, too, that there's sort of this dissolving kind of thing that happens with the illusion of having scarcity around time. And maybe part of that, that's also kind of the way that we're conditioned in society, right, to be productive and do more and constantly go, 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 go.
Right.
But how would you describe sort of that paradox of feeling we don't have enough time, but then when we're in the moment, it feels like we have all the time in the world, or we're in this meditation and we think that we've been sitting there for 5 minutes and maybe it's been 45 minutes.
Well,
what is that experience?
That is the experience of reality. But I was recently leading a retreat over at the Miyamo Spa. And I had a doctor in the retreat, and I had a neurologist. I had a physicist who we were talking about this field from which everything arises. You know, Einstein was always looking for this unified field from which the trees, the clouds, life itself, the universe arises from. And I was talking to the physicist, and I was talking about subtleties, and the more subtle we go in creation, the more power there is. For instance, you know, I could break my arm, and it would have a certain effect on my body, but if I started messing with my DNA, a subtler component of the physical body, there would be much more of an effect, just as you'd break a stick, and it would release a little energy, but if you start messing with the nucleus of an atom of a piece of wood, you might have access to nuclear energy or you know, warfare. So the truth is, the more subtle you go in creation, the more you transcend the limits that seem to exist. And if you notice, it's always now.
Yeah.
It's right now. It's always right now. As we move into the realm of being a human being and a human doing, there is the identity of time. There's what we believe as time and space and future and past, but in general, that's time is an illusion, the future is an illusion, and the past is an illusion. It's just an idea.
Uh-huh.
Like, show me, if I were a Zen teacher, I'd say, show me your face before you were born. Show me yesterday. You know, show me tomorrow. You can't, because it's only an idea.
Uh-huh.
So show me now, and you could smack them in the face, and that you would pass that koan. You know, you'd pass that question, because that would be now, and then it's not now again. It's now. So
in terms of
a lot of the checklist and the to-do list, it's just a habit, I think, that we feel like we've accomplished something with that. And I don't think there's anything wrong with accomplishing things, but I think if that it becomes our, just like when we're looking for the color red, it became dominant in our experience. If we're looking for a sense of accomplishment, that can be dominant in the experience, and that can be the only thing that seems like it's fulfilling. But if I say, okay, how much time did you sit and simply enjoy the sun on your skin or the sounds of the birds? If that were a priority, you know, that would, you could look for that too. But it tends to not be valued in this particular culture.
Right. I'm curious too then how these ideas and this being in the ever present now, or I think of it sometimes as a series of nows, it's now and then now and then now and then now again.
Right.
I'm wondering though how that informs kind of our sense. We have a lot of labels for everything too, right? But as you're saying, when we're in that now moment, we're really transcending the doing, and we're transcending, you know, time and this illusion. I'm wondering what you think of the traditional kind of definitions of spirituality, and I think maybe sometimes we even have, you know, distortions out there. There's a lot of distortions of different things. How does that maybe inform how we can live in the world as a spiritual being, and maybe what does that look like? That makes sense.
Well, spirituality means different things to different people, just like religion, just like meditation even. And so, well, let's just do this right now. Why don't you and everyone who's on this call turn your attention to the one who's listening to me. Turn your attention to that presence there that's looking through your eyes.
Mm-hmm.
Your presence that's paying attention. What is the source of this attention of yours? There's this presence there that is not just your physical body. It's not just your sensory apparatus or your brain even. There's a presence there that is beyond form, that we could look for all day long in your body and we wouldn't find it. That is the difference between being alive and dead, this liveliness, this livingness. There's this presence there that is beyond space. You cannot touch it. As the ancient Bhagavad Gita says, water cannot wet it, wind cannot dry it, weapons cannot cleave it. It's unborn, it's eternal, and it never dies. And this is the part of you that when you say spiritual to me, this is the part of me that I start using as my reference point. We talked earlier about the ego being ready to be offended at any time and is always looking for, you know, something that's going to threaten it. But the spirit knows that everything is fine. The spirit is always right here, right now. The spirit is always receiving and giving simultaneously and is perfectly balanced and still and intelligent. And this is the part that we connect with when we meditate. And you asked about why does time seem to stand still? Because when we transcend, the word transcends means to go beyond the physical sense of identity, relationships, form, phenomenon, address, numbers, letters, you know, all of that, roles, responsibilities. When we go beyond all of that and we check into who we really are, there's that part of us that is beyond all that. And when we meditate, that's how we lose track of time, because when we dwell in that company of our own spirit and in that field of pre-physical, you know, there is no time. And that's why it's really important as a on a logical level or realistic, practical level in meditation to have predetermined the amount of time you're going to meditate for. Use something objective to measure it, and then go for the practice. And so whatever you use to measure your meditation should allow you to come out of meditation slowly, so you don't use a stove timer or an alarm clock.
Right.
You use something that you can control in terms of its coming out of meditation in a slow way. That's probably one of the major mistakes people make with meditation, other than thinking they're supposed to stop thinking, is to come out of meditation too quickly.
Mm.
But back into what we were originally talking about with the thoughts and meditation, as you have an anchor for your attention, as the nervous system starts to settle down and the brainwave activity does start to settle down, almost like you're going to sleep, although you're not, what happens is that you lose track of time. You lose track of the world out there. Some people even have to look down and see if their hands are still there because they can lose track of their physical body where it is. And you transcend that external experience. That's what happens when we sleep as well. The difference between meditation and sleep is that you're at a very deep rested state according to your heart rate, your respiration rate, your brainwave function, like in sleep with meditation, but you're in an aware state. You're in an aware state versus what's going on in sleep where you're in a dull state of awareness. My husband asked me this morning, "Do you hear the dogs bark?" And I said, "No," because I was totally sleeping. But if I were meditating, I would hear it.
Right, because then all of the senses then are heightened as the attention wanes from everything else. Sure, that totally makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
So I have this interesting quote from your book, Soul Centered, in which you say, "Many resist the concept of putting themselves first because they were raised to do the opposite, to put others first and themselves last." And I love this analogy, too. It's something, even before I had read your book, it was always something that I had thought of, this image of the flight attendant on the airplane instructing the passengers to, if the oxygen mask comes down, always put that over their face before they help help others. And you say that it's a good reminder that you can't aid others until you take care of yourself first, although it took me years to apply this simple rule to my own life. I can absolutely relate to that, but I'm wondering how you feel that that notion of putting yourself first and with the use of meditation is really more in alignment with a greater sense of spiritual growth and self-awareness and maybe spiritual alignment, if I could say it that way.
Sure. Well, you know, I love your questions because, you know, you have about five things I could talk about with every question. But in general, you know, I lead a lot of retreats, and I know that self-love is the, I like to say, the final frontier. It seems like, why should I love myself? That's so selfish. I could really be helping somebody else. And, you know, we're not good to anyone if we are not present and clear and aligned with our deepest values. Everybody's got different, you know, what's important. Everybody's got a little bit of a different value system, which is fine. Mm-hmm. And integrity is key. And integrity is when you align your values with your actions. That's integrity, right? And or as the Dalai Lama put it, what you think, what you feel, what you say. Oh, no, it was Gandhi. Happiness, and I would use the word integrity, is when what you think, what you say, what you do are all in alignment. And that's what happens with meditation. It allows for that. And that is self-love. What is not self-love is actually creates a lot of stress. Now, we all know what creates a lot of stress are physical things, not having enough money and having too many bills, having too much to do and not enough time to do it, being in toxic relationships with your friends or family. But what also creates a lot of stress is saying yes when you mean no.
Yep.
Or saying, I don't care when you really do care. Or saying something you don't mean because it pleases somebody else. That is the opposite of self-love. That is codependence, and that is not, it's when you're in somebody else's business because you want to please them, you're not, no one's there for you. And that constant ignoring yourself, discounting your own opinion, ignoring what you really want. You know, when you take into account the commandment, love thy neighbor as thyself, if you're blowing yourself off, if you're not taking into account what you really believe or need, if you're not listening to yourself or giving yourself what you physically need and want, you're not loving yourself. And so love thy neighbor as thyself becomes really an interesting place, a point of contemplation or reflection. How do you love yourself? And the Buddha says you can search the entire world for someone more deserving than your love than you, and you will not find them. Yeah, and it's hard to when you grow up in a family of people that are either narcissists or codependent or addicts or anyone that you had to kind of manage their energy in order for you to be safe. I mean, a lot of us had to do that, and it turns into bad habits as we get older, because as we get older, those survival mechanisms are not helpful. They just become bad habits. So we have to almost relearn that it's okay to love ourselves, that it's okay to say yes and mean it and no and mean it, and other people's emotions and other people's responses to that, though we are compassionate and we want to find that, they are their business. How someone thinks of me or what they think of me is their business. You know, and that's hard. It's hard for anyone who's had to kind of walk around, you know, just in scanning their environment for safety. But the truth is your business is how you're doing, not how everybody else is doing. And that's funny in a service industry, you know, a lot of us who are interested in helping people, whether you've got a radio show, whether you're a meditation teacher or a social worker or a doctor, there's this impetus to constantly give from an empty well. And it's actually there's no wholeness in it, and it's not sustainable with all this conversation around sustainability. It's not sustainable.
Right. And then once you're in alignment by doing these things, let's say, you know, we're loving the self, we're putting those needs and wants first, is it from that place that we can cultivate self-compassion, and then how can we get a deeper understanding of the self and sort of these healthier responses that lead to self-love? I feel like that's kind of managing the energy of others can kind of lead to that same sort of feedback loop of not believing what you think and then kind of getting in that cycle. So if we utilize meditation to also focus on self-love, then how does that lead to self-compassion and a deeper understanding, right? You can't really exercise your wants and needs if you don't know what they are, I guess.
Right, exactly. Well, exactly. I believe that meditation or the practice, what ultimately ends up being mindfulness, because that's the benefit of meditation, is this practice of being engaged in your life, doing what you're doing with full awareness and no judgment. And when you're fully engaged mentally, engaged with what you're doing, you're much more self-aware because the mind isn't drifting away. How am I doing now? How am I doing now? It's actually like relearning how to live. But what they find with a lot of research that's going on with up in the University of Wisconsin with Dr. Richard Davidson is they're finding that there is such a thing as self-compassion, which is kind of a relatively new area of study. And what is self-compassion? Self-compassion is understanding your own humanity, loving yourself even when you're not happy or even when you make a mistake or you're not living up to your expectations, is to have this compassion for your own humanity and forgive yourself. And it's a lot different than self-esteem. Self-esteem is based on external measures, like, you know, you got the most popular or you got an award for your book or something. So self-compassion is really something that's developed versus something you know, a lot of these things are realizations. They're actually realizations versus a philosophy that you take on. And with meditation and mindfulness, you start to understand that you are kind and you are aware and you're part of the human condition just like anyone else is. So it's a really important component of someone's self-awareness. It's imagine that meditation is your life of blossoming. You know, self-compassion just happens along with that. It's not something you have to cultivate. It's something you have to become aware of, but you don't have to actually do it. It does itself just from the practice of meditation.
Yeah. And I think then that leads to, if you're in that space of self-love and it kind of naturally unfolds from that space, then what you're doing maybe is kind of tapping into that all-pervasive force that actually gives the wellspring from which we can provide then to others, right? Because we're already anchored into that center in ourselves.
Yeah, because our soul or our spirit or whatever you want to call that one who's looking through your eyes is naturally generous, is naturally compassionate, is naturally kind, is naturally non-judgmental. And the practice, I mean, how judgmental can you be? Let's say you're doing a silent mantra practice. How judgmental, you're not cultivating judgment when you're doing that. One of the essentials I tell people when I teach meditation is to be kind to yourself and not to judge your experience as good or bad, even though you may like some more than others. Just to simply stay seated and still while you're going through your meditation, even when you've got the impulse to stop and return a phone call or check your email. And this starts to cultivate an ability to stay with yourself, an ability to bear witness to your emotions and the anxiety that arises when you have an impetus to get up and you don't do it. It starts to create that. And it starts to create this awareness of this presence that you are versus the impulse to be engaged in activity. I think it just it creates a new normal, a responsive, present, non-judgmental, compassionate, engaged presence of yours. It's a new normal in the way you live.
And I think maybe a much needed kind of cultural shift. You know, we all know that there's so much going on in the world today, and part of it starts from within. So maybe on that note, could I ask that you lead us through a guided visualization and meditation, maybe about 10 minutes?
Sure.
Wonderful.
Sure.
That would be great.
Okay. So let's see. Here's what I would suggest. Let me just review really quickly before we go into this. It's ideal mm-hmm. to be comfortable. So whatever that looks like for you, and maybe what you can do, Kelly, is mute everybody if they're not already muted. I don't know if you can see them or if you have a dashboard. But the key
yeah,
is...
Yeah, I think we're good.
Mm-hmm. Oh, good. To be comfortable, to take your cell phone and just turn it off or airplane mode or put it in the other room, to find a comfortable place to sit up. The five essentials for any meditation are these. You'll always have thoughts. It doesn't mean you're doing it wrong, so don't give up. Just come back to the focus. Number two, be kind to yourself. Your body's always overhearing what you're saying to yourself, so just be sweet to yourself. You just appreciate yourself for even being on this call or even attempting to do this. Number three, give up any expectations about what, quote-unquote, should happen in meditation and just let what is happening happen. It'll help you to appreciate your life even more. And number four, don't try too hard. It'll only give you a headache and it will not help you to have that natural settling down of the nervous system, which is important in meditation. Just like sleep, you naturally sleep. You will naturally be able to meditate. It doesn't require extra effort. And number four, don't give up. Even if you're restless and bored, as Deepak Chopra said, even if you're restless and bored, it's a really good meditation. So that being said, I'll guide you into a very simple meditation for a few minutes, and you can just follow along with me.
That'd be great. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. So let's begin by giving ourselves some slow, long, deep breaths through your nose. This sends a signal to your nervous system that it's okay to relax. Inhaling fully and deeply, and exhaling fully and slowly. And then letting your breath return to its natural rhythm and depth. Throughout this practice, you'll be breathing through your nose. So with your eyes closed, you may begin to notice that you're a little more aware of the sounds in the environment around you, far, and maybe even the sounds in your body. Begin to welcome everything you hear. And notice, like my voice, that sound arises from the silence and returns to the silence. Also, with your eyes closed, you may begin to notice that you're a little more aware of the physical sensations that you have. I like to begin meditations by relaxing the body, and I'll guide you through a simple body awareness practice. Throughout this practice, your job is to bring your attention to the areas I mention, and then simply notice the sensations there, and then relax the body. So we'll begin by relaxing the scalp and the forehead. Your eyes. Your cheeks. Your mouth. Even your ears. And tuck your chin in slightly, allowing the back of your neck to lengthen just a little bit. And let your shoulders move down and relax. Feeling your upper arms, your forearms, your palms, and your fingers. Let your hips fully relax wherever you're sitting. feeling the support of the chair or the floor or the sofa. And feel your spine as it reaches from your tailbone to the base of your skull, like a tree reaching for the sky. Noticing the sensations in your upper back, your mid-back, and your low back. Relaxing your chest, your diaphragm, and your belly. Letting go of any tension in your hips, pelvis, and hip joints. Noticing any sensation in your thighs, in your lower legs. If your feet are on the floor, just letting that floor support your feet as you relax into them. Into the floor, relaxing your toes. Now feel your whole body. Feel your whole body and allow the body sensations to interest you, to charm you. Maybe you notice the air on your skin. Or you notice a slight tingling or pulsing. Aliveness or your heartbeat. Notice the movement of your chest as you breathe naturally through your nose. And bring your attention now to the movement of your breath, the cool air as you inhale, and the warmed breath as you exhale. And then keeping your attention on the pauses between each breath too. Your breath is always an anchor to the present moment. Simply notice the sensations that are present with each natural breath. We'll do this for one more minute, and if your attention drifts away, just come back again. Your breath is right here all the time, just like your body. You're doing it correctly as long as you're not trying too hard. Keep coming back and you let go of expectations. And keeping your eyes closed, simply sit in the stillness once again, becoming aware of the body sensations as you might stretch a little into the space around you. Become aware of the sounds in the environment, giving yourself some deeper breaths through your nose. And when you're ready to engage with the world out there, you can slowly begin to open your eyes, first with a downward gaze. When you're ready to open them all the way, you can do so. There's no rush. It's always important to take your time because meditation does really create a relaxing experience. And the reason we meditate is so we can live a more mindful, relaxed, connected, compassionate life. And so it really doesn't matter what your experiences are in meditation. What really matters is that you did it. But is that, how are you doing, Kelly?
It's very powerful, and I found at the end that I actually I gave a little yawn there. I was so relaxed that I was yawning. And you know what I noticed too, when I come out of that kind of place, it almost, for me, it takes even a few seconds like to adjust my eyes again. It's almost as if it's not just the breath and the nervous system that becomes more quiet. It's like all of the parts do, you know. So it takes a second to when you open your eyes to kind of refocus and get your bearing. Yeah.
Well,
and
it's like coming out of, it's like waking up in the morning. You know, you really, most people don't jump out of bed, hopefully, and if they do, they know how that makes them feel for the rest of the day. You know, coming out of bed slowly and moving from one state of consciousness to another. I mean, you're in a very deep state of rest. Even in 7 minutes, you go into almost as deep a rest as sleep. It's different than the sleep process, which takes you from alpha to alpha to theta. And it takes about 20 minutes or so, but in meditation, it happens faster. So we never underestimate the depth of our meditation, even if in our own opinion, it doesn't feel like anything's happening.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. It's such a powerful, powerful thing.
Yeah.
So gosh, to have a practice like that every day, there's really, it's exciting to think about the possibilities for, as you say, the shift in the state of consciousness and awareness and how we gain self-knowledge and interaction with others, interaction with our world, and all of those profound things that come as a result of something like a daily practice. It's quite amazing and profound.
Yeah, it is. It works only if you do it, not if you read
about
it or listen to us talking about it.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely.